Hi, I'm Francesca, a registered nutritional therapist, and you're listening to another episode of the Empowered Perimenopause podcast. Welcome. My aim is to bring you down-to-earth, conversational episodes that help you develop a deeper understanding of how your body's changing in your 40s, and most importantly, how you can support yourself throughout this wonderful transitional phase of your life. Join me for my solo episodes and also episodes with guests for fun, fresh, truthful chat on all things health and happiness in your 40s. And now onto the episode. Welcome back to another episode of the Empowered Perimenopause podcast with me, your host, Francesca. Now, before we dive into today's episode, I just want to let you know about a couple of free resources that you can get right now in case you haven't got them, you didn't know about them. One of those is my Perimenopause Blueprint Guide, and the other one is the recording of my Thriving Through Perimenopause Masterclass. So both of these are free. Just head over to my website, francescaliparotti.com, and you'll see both of them available on the homepage, or just go into the show notes of this episode where you'll see the links there. Okay, so today's episode is all about sleep, because sleep is one of the first things that women start to notice that changes as they move into perimenopause. And whether a woman even knows that she's moved into perimenopause yet, she might just start to notice sleep changes, and she could be late 30s, early 40s, and she's just starting to notice this. It's usually trouble falling asleep, it's waking up in the night, or waking up far too early of a morning, maybe 4 a.m., half four, and just not being able to get back to sleep again, and that's it for the day. You end up just getting out of bed. Or many women find that they wake up around four and they just take ages to get back to sleep. And by the time they fall back to sleep, their alarm's gone off. So obviously any of these is going to affect the way we are, way we feel, the way we are the next day, and have a knock-on impact to every other symptom experience involved in perimenopause. So it can become this kind of vicious cycle. So sleep is something we all want to safeguard. We all want to make sure that, you know, we can have a good night's sleep. And so it's a really important topic to address. Now, if people understand the benefits of progesterone in terms of how it helps to support sleep, a lot of people just assume when they have these, start to have these sleep issues, that it's just low progesterone. But actually, estrogen plays a really big role in our sleep quality as well. So in today's episode, we're going to sort of unpack how both estrogen and progesterone influence sleep and why changes in both of these hormones can disrupt the way that we sleep, the quality of our sleep, waking up in the night, but what we can then do to support our body naturally. Because we're also going to be talking about, you know, other hormones that play a role, like cortisol, insulin. And of course, the most important thing once we know this is what can we actually do? So let's have a look first at estrogen's role in sleep. So estrogen helps to maintain our body's master clock. So this is known as our circadian rhythms. Estrogen basically helps to regulate this circadian rhythm. And this is, it's a 24-hour internal body clock that's controlled by something called the suprachiasmatic nucleus, SCN. You don't need to remember that, but it's an area in the brain, sort of around the eye area. And that is basically what's controlling our 24-hour body clock. So a clue there is that it's around the eye area. This SCN in the brain responds to light and dark cues. One of the reasons why I and lots of other practitioners like myself bang on about the fact that we need to get into natural daylight within sort of 30 minutes of waking every day to tell our brain, this SCN in the brain, that it's daytime, it's time to make cortisol because we need it at that point in the day. And like, you know, vice versa, we want to expose that SCN in the brain, eyes, to darkness, dim lighting and darkness during the evening and later at night before bed, and obviously sleep in a darkened room, because all of this is that SCN is responding to these light dark cues. So if it gets the dark cues in the evening, it's a cue for it to start, for the body and the brain to start producing melatonin and not make cortisol, because we want, that's what we want at nighttime. In the morning we want it the other way around. But we'll get to more of that as we go through the episode. So estrogen, like I said, is this really important hormone that regulates this circadian rhythm that's controlled by the SCN. So when estrogen levels start to fluctuate and or drop, so they're fluctuating erratically in the earlier stages of perimenopause, even though estrogen levels are usually at that stage still quite high or higher than they've even ever been before, but they're fluctuating erratically, which can affect this body clock management. And then obviously they drop as part of that roller coaster, those levels will just dip. And then when it eventually starts to genuinely decline later in perimenopause, closer to menopause, it just really starts to throw off this rhythm, making it harder for us to fall asleep, stay asleep, and causing us to sort of wake up at random times during the night, and just not waking up at the right times. So it's like you could wake, like I said, that sort of 4 a.m. wake up, that's the wrong time to be awake. It's just too early. But if we wake up, we find ourselves awake at that time and that's it, we just cannot get back to sleep, then we know that something is off with our body's circadian rhythm. So that's why that early waking or restless sleep, it can really start to appear as estrogen starts to decline. So we can already start to have sleep issues in the earlier stages of perimenopause when progesterone starts to decline, because progesterone starts to decline before estrogen does, way before estrogen does. So then if we add to that the decline in estrogen later on, it can bring about sort of new, sort of a change in our sleep issues maybe, or maybe we've just got a handle on them and then now estrogen is starting to decline years later or however long later, and it brings about new, sleep issues, usually early waking. Estrogen also impacts the production of a brain chemical, a neurotransmitter called acetylcholine. So low levels of declining estrogen and or fluctuating estrogen in that roller coaster can start to reduce its production. So acetylcholine is a brain chemical that's important for supporting the what's known as the autonomic nervous system, particularly the parasympathetic rest and digest state of our nervous system. When the opposite of that is fight or flight. So when we're in the fight or flight stress mode, if that's switched on, it's very difficult for us to fall asleep. And that acetylcholine is a wonderful neurotransmitter for switching off that fight flight and putting us in that, supporting that sort of rest and digest, also known as parasympathetic nervous system state, which is where we're able to fall asleep easier and stay asleep. So it promotes that deeper sleep when the brain, it sort of supports when the brain is reorganizing its short-term memories into long-term ones. So that particular portion of the deep sleep phases. So that's what acetylcholine is really helpful for. So not only is it going to be helpful for supporting deeper sleep, but it's going to be helpful for supporting, the organization of memories that we should be doing as we sleep. This acetylcholine also supports what's known as vagal tone. So you may have heard of toning the vagus nerve or something like that. So this basically refers to how effectively the vagus nerve communicates with your brain, heart, and gut. So the vagus nerve basically connects the brain with the rest of the body, essentially. And what's known as having high vagal tone, so toning this vagus nerve, means that we'll have a calmer mood, we might have better stress resilience, we would have lower inflammation in the body and better sleep. And the opposite of that, if we have low vagal tone, we can have low resilience to stress, higher inflammation and issues sleeping and sort of a less calmer mood. So acetylcholine is really helpful for supporting this vagal tone. And then low estrogen, declining estrogen, big fluctuations in estrogen can lead to lower acetylcholine, which then leads to reduced vagal tone and therefore difficulty switching off at night and staying asleep. Estrogen also supports the production of serotonin, our mood, our sort of mood and well-being brain chemical neurotransmitter. But serotonin is also a precursor to melatonin, which means it helps in the product, it's needed in the production of melatonin. We go from serotonin, it's converted into melatonin. So this is the sleep hormone that helps us to fall asleep. So how that works is we have the amino acid tryptophan. So we would get that, for example, from eating protein foods that are made up of complete proteins, really foods that are rich in tryptophan would include things like chicken, turkey. So tryptophan is then converted into 5-HTP, which is then converted into the neurotransmitter serotonin and then melatonin. And low estrogen could start to lead to lower serotonin levels and therefore lower melatonin levels. So this doesn't just impact our mood with the lower serotonin, but then it has that knock-on impact to sleep because we're not making enough melatonin if we don't have enough serotonin. So that makes it harder to fall asleep. Affects our mood, of course, and contributes to anxiety. So you know, even if we have mood issues and more anxiety, that in and of itself is going to impact our ability to fall asleep, because we're just going to be lying there with anxious thoughts, low mood, thinking about, you know, bad things, worrying, and that's going to make it harder to fall asleep. So it's kind of like a blend of all of these different things together, but just to kind of highlight where, you know, what estrogen's role is in all of this. So we, as I said, we need enough protein, particularly from animal sources, to have enough tryptophan coming into the body so that we can convert that into serotonin. So under eating, skipping protein on your meals, particularly with dinner, can really make things worse. Estrogen helps regulate cortisol and blood sugar levels. And when estrogen's low, or, you know, on its crazy erratic roller coaster, even if it's not necessarily low levels, you're more likely to have blood sugar dips at night. And that leads to a spike in cortisol, because a drop in blood sugar at any time of the day, particularly at night, is going to be a stressor. The brain is perceiving that as a life-threatening situation. And that increases, or spikes, I should say, cortisol. And then we're going to wake up, because cortisol shouldn't be spiking at night, during the night. It should be spiking in the morning when it's time to get up, known as the cortisol awakening response, which I've talked about in previous episodes and I'll continue to talk about. So that cortisol spike's going to, you know, the body's like, right, it's time to wake up. So that's that middle of the night waking. You're not necessarily waking up anxious. You're just waking up like, whoa, okay, I'm wide awake and I can't get back to sleep. You may eventually fall back to sleep, but it can take some time. Stress, under eating, imbalanced meals. So again, low protein meals, not having enough fats in your meals, really overdoing refined carbohydrates in your meals. All of this just adds fuel to the fire. Stress adds fuel to the fire, because stress also spikes cortisol. Exercising, for example, intense exercise during the evening can be a cortisol spike. So all of this will just, you know, like I said, add fuel to this, to the fire that's already starting to burn. Low estrogen can heighten anxiety and low mood. So we've just talked about, obviously, that in terms of, you know, serotonin being the mood, happy mood chemical. And when that's low, we're going to increase anxiety, low mood issues. And, you know, both of those are going to impact your ability to unwind and sleep deeply. And when the brain senses hormone decline, it shouts at the ovaries by releasing more FSH and LH, these two hormones that the brain is releasing to get the ovaries to actually, you know, produce hormones and ovulate and make progesterone, make estrogen. But the spikes in this, in FSH and LH, can actually create agitation, hot flushes, and anxiety that can wake us up in the night. So this is really just showing you that the decline in estrogen that would happen in the later stages of perimenopause has an impact, but also the erratic nature of it. So even when estrogen, you know, let's say you're early 40s, even mid 40s, and you will, you know, you most likely have normal or even high levels of estrogen in the body, but you're still, you know, this is perimenopause, but you're on the estrogen roller coaster. So those highs and then these sharp lows can still create this situation of low estrogen in sort of in that moment at that time, and bring about the same issues that affect our sleep. So that's estrogen. And let's now have a look at progesterone. So we kind of, you may already know by now that progesterone does support sleep. And this is the hormone that starts to decline first in perimenopause. Like I said, estrogen is declining later in perimenopause, closer towards reaching menopause itself. But progesterone starts to decline early, late 30s, early 40s, we're already starting to see a decline. And that's because we only make progesterone as a result of ovulating. And ovulation from late 30s onwards is becoming sort of harder to achieve. You know, we're ovulating once every month in every cycle. And that we just start from that age onwards, we start to have more and more cycles, menstrual cycles, where we don't ovulate. Or if we do, you know, sometimes we manage to ovulate wonderfully, and other months we don't at all, and other months we do, but we just don't ovulate as robustly, and therefore we don't make enough or as much progesterone as we need. So that's why it's on the decline from that age onwards. And that, you know, even with normal cycles and maybe no other particular symptoms noticed, that can, you know, that's sort of happening in the background, and that can cause new anxiety, restless nights, lighter sleep, struggling to fall asleep. And this can all be completely new to this person. That was my experience. When I hit around 41, or just before I turned 41, I started to notice a bit of random, unexplained anxiety in the evenings, just sitting, watching TV or washing the dishes after dinner, having no idea. I knew I was feeling anxious, but just I had no idea why. It was all very strange. And then I was struggling to fall asleep. I was waking in the night. So that was all I had. That was all I noticed at first. And it took me a couple of days to thought, oh, okay, I think I know what this is. I'm 41. I'm moving into the stages where perimenopause is kicking in and progesterone is likely declining for me. Once I got a handle on that, which, you know, I luckily do this for work, so I knew what to do, and I did sort, you know, manage to sort it. And we'll talk about those things in a moment. Because we can support, even though progesterone is declining, we can actually be supporting our body to ovulate more, better, so that we can, you know, try and counteract this decline in progesterone as long as we can. We're always going to get to a stage in perimenopause where it's kind of no longer as possible or as easy to be supporting ovulation. It's not just a simple case of just support ovulation, just keep supporting ovulation. You know, you will get to a point late 40s, closer to reaching menopause, where that's just not going to be possible because the ovaries just aren't doing it anymore. But for, you know, good few years in that earlier stages of perimenopause, we can be supporting the body to ovulate and make more progesterone. And that's certainly what I did, plus using some specific supplements at night and just changing my habits at night, which we'll talk about in a minute. And that really just changed it for me, just flipped the switch and I was back. You know, the anxiety had gone, the restless nights, the weight, the trouble falling asleep had all gone. So progesterone is basically, it has a natural sedative. It is a natural sedative. It has anti-anxiety effects because it increases what's known as GABA, your calming brain chemical. So it is an absolutely, you know, wonderful hormone, of course, for the things that we know about progesterone, like protecting the uterine lining, protecting breast tissue from the proliferative effects of estrogen, supporting, you know, a healthy pregnancy. But it works so well in the brain because of the fact that it increases GABA. So when your body breaks progesterone down in, so what's known as metabolizing progesterone, it makes a compound called allopregnanolone. This is a metabolite of progesterone that's deeply calming, and it promotes restful sleep for most women. But so, you know, as we start to lose it in the earlier stages of perimenopause and when we keep going, that's, you know, one of the biggest reasons why we're not having this restful sleep anymore. But obviously, as we've seen, estrogen plays a big role as well. But we're just talking about progesterone in this moment. But for a small subset of women, this allopregnanolone, the metabolite of progesterone, it can actually worsen anxiety or low mood. So for some women, you know, even if they're making wonderful amounts of progesterone, it's being converted into allopregnanolone because there's another metabolite it's also getting converted into. But if, as long as a lot of it is being converted into allopregnanolone, for most women, like I said, it's promoting restful sleep. But there is this subset of women who just don't get on very well with allopregnanolone, and it makes their anxiety worse, their mood worse. So this would be quite characteristic of people with PMDD. It could be one of the reasons they're experiencing those horrendous mood issues before their period. It could be because we were making progesterone in that luteal phase and they're not getting on well with allopregnanolone. So for some women, you know, supplementing with progesterone, taking progesterone hormone therapy doesn't always help those women because they're not going to do well with allopregnanolone. But, you know, for most women, they are going to do well with it. I started taking progesterone about 4 months ago. So I'm nearly 46 and I spent from 41 to 45, so about 4 years, really supporting my body to ovulate so that I was making, you know, progesterone as many months as possible. And with tracking my baseline body temperature every morning, I was noticing that I, you know, going off that information, I was actually managing to ovulate every single month throughout 41 to 45. But then I got to a point where I was realizing I am still ovulating sort of around 45, realized I am still ovulating, but I'm probably just not making enough progesterone. And I did start to do some testing with progesterone, urine, blood, you know, because again, I do this in my practice, so I know what to do and I know, you know, how to sort of interpret it. And I was seeing a trend in, yes, I was making progesterone, but at that certain point in my cycle when it should be sort of higher, it was just always quite on the low side. And I thought, okay, now might be the time for me to actually start putting progesterone therapy in. So that's body identical progesterone, not progestin, nothing synthetic. I went for the body identical progesterone in capsule form. It's called micronized progesterone. There's different brands. And for some women, that's all they need to start sort of using, you know, before they even look at estrogen itself. And I personally know that I respond extremely well to allopregnanolone, because when I take my progesterone, I do it cyclically. So I take it in the luteal phase of my cycle each evening before bed. And I have the most amazing sleep with that. But I am also doing all of the right things, which we're going to talk about in a minute, that support a good night's sleep anyway. So even in the portion of my cycle that I don't take progesterone, I also do sleep really, really well. I just tend to notice this additional boost when I'm taking the progesterone itself. So I think if I wasn't doing all of those right things, it may help to a point, but it wouldn't be, you know, the magic bullet. We do really need to look at nutrition, lifestyle, and potential supplements that can be really helpful to support, you know, a good night's sleep in the first place, before we really start to look at these things as magic bullets, because they just can't be without all of that. So we'll talk about all that in a moment. So if you're waking up anxious or panicky in the middle of the night, I would think low progesterone and potentially, you know, low GABA, GABA being the neurotransmitter that progesterone converts into or makes more of. But if we're waking up wide awake, but we're not anxious, I would think more likely estrogen drops, whether your levels are genuinely declining because you're nearing to menopause, or whether it was a drop as part of the roller coaster. Or I would also think a cortisol spike, and that could be caused by the drop in estrogen. It could be caused by low blood sugar, you know, either way. But if your weight, a clue of low blood sugar would be waking up wide awake, not necessarily anxious, but you're hungry or even a little bit shaky, you know, feeling quite starving in the middle of the night, that would be most likely a blood sugar dip. And then that cortisol kicked in to wake you up. You know, so I always ask people, like, when you wake up in the night, do you feel hungry? Do you feel, and some people say yes. And I always need to get up, you know, with, even if it's sort of 3 a.m, I'll get up and I have to go to the kitchen and get something because they're just that shaky and hungry. That is definitely, you know, in my book, that would be low blood sugar. So then we would look at what they eat for breakfast, for lunch, for dinner, what they're snacking on, what they're drinking. All of these things throughout the entire day will have a huge, does have a huge impact on whether or not somebody will wake up in the night with a blood sugar dip. So what can we do? This is the best, you know, the most important part is like, okay, we know the information, that's the empowerment part, but what can we do about it? So with regards to blood sugar, we really want to make sure we're eating enough food, we're taking in enough energy and enough protein, good fats, good quality, slow release carbohydrates, not too much, with every meal. Protein being the absolute star of the show, at least 30 grams of protein with every meal. Yes, also breakfast being the most important meal to have that big dose, that, you know, optimal dose of protein. But, you know, we want the same at every meal, ideally. The slow release carbs, particularly at dinner. So I think a lot of people I speak to are still just skipping carbs at dinner. They're maybe just having them with lunch or just with breakfast and lunch and not with dinner. Dinner would be the most important meal to get those slow release carbs in, and definitely not skip them. If I ever have a, you know, accidentally for whatever reason have just protein and veg for my dinner and really don't have any carbs, I always struggle to fall asleep. And I'm lying there thinking, I know exactly what I've done, like by mistake. You know, really, for me now, it happens very, very few and far between. I cannot remember the last time I would have skipped the carbs at dinner. It would just be like an accident for whatever reason. And I just can't sleep. So always slow release carbs with dinner. They actually help with that conversion from tryptophan into serotonin, and obviously serotonin then converts into melatonin, like I said earlier. So slow release carbs, about one closed fist size portion with your dinner. So that could be brown rice, it could be sweet potato, baby new potato, quinoa, If you're having beans and lentils as your carb source, you could have a couple of closed fist sizes of those. It could be other starchy veg as well. So making sure that we're having those in to really help stabilize sugar overnight, blood sugar, and then of course the healthy fats, olive oil, avocado, coconut oil, coconut cream, milk, nuts, seeds, and of course that dose of protein with every meal, and plenty of fiber from colorful vegetables, you know, all the different colors, the dark green leafy vegetables, really, really important to have that fiber there as well. And avoid going to bed hungry, you know, or after a large spike crash meal. Now, obviously, this is going to happen sometimes. We're just not going to be able to, you know, avoid all the time having like a big, maybe a bigger meal. Maybe we've gone out for a meal with friends or family, and it's been at a time that you couldn't really control, and you've had, you know, something that you wouldn't necessarily have if you were eating at home. You know, it's done. There's no point beating yourself up about it. Maybe just wait to go to bed a little bit later, so you're not going to bed on that big meal. But just be aware that that sort of large spike, you know, if you're having a big bowl of pasta or you've had a big pizza, you know, it's quite a lot of refined carbohydrate there. So you're likely to have a blood sugar dip in the night. So I'd always just say maybe before bed, try and have some protein before you go to bed, like a smaller amount, something like, I mean, it could be some fat, like good quality nut butter, cashew butter, almond butter on a small oat cake or in a tiny bit of banana or apple, and just have that before you go to bed to sort of try and prevent that crash in the middle of the night. Skipping dinner, absolute no-no. You're definitely going to wake up in the night with a blood sugar crash. And then we want to just be supporting our circadian rhythm now more than ever, because obviously, as we said, estrogen is really helpful. It helps to control the circadian rhythm. So when it starts to go erratic, when it starts to decline, we just don't have that same sort of robust level of, you know, regulation with that. So like I mentioned earlier, get into morning daylight within 30 minutes of waking, maximum an hour of waking, you know, the sooner the better. When these mornings now are getting darker and darker, and we can't just get straight out into natural daylight when we wake up, you can use a 10,000 lux light box. These are quite cheap, affordable on Amazon these days, £20-30. Doesn't have to be a fancy one. Just get one that you can manually switch on in the morning when you wake up, and just expose yourself, you know, be around that light for a good 30 minutes after waking. I've got a few in the house for all the different rooms that I might like be in the morning. So one that I turn on right by my bed, but then once I've got out of bed, which is quite quick, I just make the bed and leave the room. I'll go into the next room and turn on the other one. And there's also one in another room that I might be in. So me and my partner both have that light, you know, exposure first thing in the morning. And then we just get outside as soon as we can once the light is up. But during the spring, during the summer, you know, it's great just to get out of bed and go outside. If you work from home, just get outside and then come back and get yourself ready for the day. If you are commuting off somewhere, if it's like an hour, you know, if it's sort of 2 hours after you wake up, you do want to try and figure out how can I just get into even 10 minutes of daylight within that sort of waking up window and not waiting until you're actually leaving the house. Reduce blue light stimulation, blue light exposure, and any kind of sort of stimulations at night. So blue light would be your overhead lights, your general overhead lights in the house. Blue light coming from TV, from screens, from your phone, from tablets. All of this is artificial blue light that just stimulates the production of cortisol. Going into your eyes, that SCN, part of the brain that we talked about earlier, that is how what regulates your circadian rhythm. It is responding to light and dark cues. So if at nighttime that SCN is getting light, so from blue lights, from overhead lights, from screens, it's just saying, oh, okay, so it's time to wake up. Let's just make cortisol then. And then by the time you want to go to bed, you're lying there like, why can't I sleep? Well, because your brain thought it was, you told it that it needed to make cortisol because you gave it this blue light and these screens. So what's really great to use during the evening at home is blue light blocking glasses. Just be careful. There's so many out there nowadays and they have to be made properly, you know, in a certain way that they do actually block blue light. The brand that I know is well studied, well researched is called Boncharge. There's also a UK website called Block Blue Light. I think it's just blockbluelight.co.uk. Those are pretty good as well. But Boncharge, I know, is definitely a good one. So wearing the blue light blocking glasses through the evening while you're watching TV, while you're on your tablets, your screens, looking at the phone, and then always having a good hour before bedtime where you just don't use any screens at all. So let people know, set those boundaries. I'm not going to be on my phone. I'm not going to reply to WhatsApp messages, whatever it might be, after whatever time. For me personally, it's like after 7 o'clock, people know I'm just not there. Sometimes I might be, but absolute latest would be sort of 7:30, 7:45 to get a reply from me, because I'm just not going to be looking at my phone after that time unless I'm quickly checking the weather for the next day or something like that. I'm not scrolling. I'm not on Instagram. I'm not on WhatsApps or emails or anything. So just having that hour before bed where you don't look at any screens. At least 40 minutes, half an hour, 40 minutes at least, as long as you've had the blue light blocking glasses on throughout the evening. Maybe just 45 minutes would be enough before bed to have no screen time. And in that time, maybe do some gentle yoga poses that help to restore you, get ready for a restorative night's sleep, meditate. You can do a yoga nidra, a lying down body scan meditation in a nice dim setting, get yourself all cozy in a blanket. Read a book in dim lighting. I'll just sit up in bed with the Himalayan salt lamp on and read my book. It's enough lighting for me to get it to read it, and eventually just drop off into a nice sleep. So that is those two things. So the morning exposure to daylight and then, blocking blue light basically during the evening and having a screen-free hour before bed. Those are so, so powerful. No supplements or magic bullets to help you sleep are going to help you, that much, if at all, if we're not doing these things. And this is free. This is, apart from buying the blue light blocking glasses, it's free stuff. It's just a habit. It's just a routine to get into. And keeping to a consistent bedtime and wake time, even on weekends, is also really important. So the more you can just get to bed at the same time every day and wake up at the same time every day, maybe give or take an hour, half an hour at the weekends, but otherwise trying to keep it consistent. That's another thing that SCN is always going to be responding to. Herbal support, nutrient support that can support sleep are basically things that support the nervous system, things that calm the nervous system, support GABA, that calming neurotransmitter that progesterone makes. This is really the key way to support sleep. If we can support our nervous system to calm down, so, the opposite of the excitatory part of our nervous system that's like, okay, we're awake, let's go. We want to calm our nervous system. It's those nutrients that support that will help to support a good sleep. So things like L-theanine, lemon balm, passion flower, chamomile, valerian. These are wonderful herbs, and L-theanine is an amino acid, but the others are sort of herbs that are really great for calming the nervous system and supporting a restorative sleep. Magnesium glycinate is wonderful. I have been taking magnesium glycinate every evening for as long as I can remember now. And I think it's the one thing, that sort of cliche question when someone says, if you're stuck on a desert island, what's the one supplement in this case that you might bring with you? It's a clear answer is magnesium glycinate all the way. There's also a form of magnesium called magnesium threonate. That isn't as common. It's more expensive as well. But if you can get your hands on it and you have the budget for it, it is really nice. You would probably just need maybe 200, 300 milligrams, or you could have a mix of magnesium glycinate and magnesium threonate. And maybe just take 150 milligrams of magnesium threonate and 150 or 200 milligrams of magnesium glycinate. Take them both together, or, one or the other. If you're just using magnesium glycinate, I'd say 300 to 400 milligrams each evening. Both of those just help with relaxation, GABA, and melatonin production. So really nice things to do there to support sleep. And so, like I said, if we're thinking, okay, it's low progesterone, I'll speak to my doctor and start taking body identical progesterone. Whilst it might support, of course it will, if you've lost that hormone and you put it back in, it's going to support, but it's not going to be, like I said, that magic bullet unless we are doing all of these lifestyle things and we're thinking about our diet and the way that I explained it, and maybe using these supportive supplements as well, just to see if, how far you can go with those, which is probably very far. to support progesterone, like I said, if we're still having regular cycles and we're in the sort of early to mid phases of perimenopause, like I did it, I did this from age 41 up to 45, I was taking Vitex. So it's also known as chasteberry, Agnus castus. Vitex is a herb that can encourage ovulation and a stronger progesterone production as a result of the ovulation. So I absolutely swore by Vitex for those years. It really, really did work for me. And I would, you know, any client around that sort of stage of perimenopause, I will always try this. And for most of them, they say, yeah, I'm really, really noticing differences in my sleep and my PMS and my periods aren't as heavy anymore, because the Vitex has helped them to actually ovulate more months than they would have done if they didn't intervene and use the Vitex. And of course, you know, they're managing stress, they're supporting their sleep, and all of that is going to help with ovulation as well. So that's something that you can consider depending on what stage of perimenopause you're at. And for estrogen support, now this doesn't raise estrogen. Nothing is going to raise estrogen in the body other than, you know, actual estrogen hormone therapy. But that, you know, that's not what we're talking about today. But for estrogen balance, black cohosh, which is a herb, and maca root. So like I said, they don't raise estrogen, but they can support its balance, and they can support certain symptoms like hot flushes, night sweats, you know, things that are preventing us from falling asleep or making us wake up in the night. These things can support those. And of course, we cannot have a conversation about supporting sleep without talking about stress and supporting the nervous system. I've talked about some supplementary ways to support the nervous system. So the magnesium glycinate, L-theanine, lemon balm, passion flower. But lifestyle-wise, you know, we just really want to be putting things in place that support the vagal tone that I talked about earlier, and just support our nervous system to support our brain to feel safe, feel safety. So the brain is constantly scanning for threat, and it's picking up on all of our modern day stressors, which even include WhatsApp groups, things pinging off all the time on your phone, you know, messages just coming through all the time, and you're either being notified every single time a message comes in, or you're constantly checking, even at random times of the day when, you know, back in the day, we would never be checking for messages at 10 o'clock at night because there was no medium for messages to come through. And how well did our sort of parents and grandparents sleep? Probably a hell of a lot better than we did. So really just being aware that any sort of stress, all of this modern day stress, financial worries, relationship issues, being unhappy, you know, negative mindsets, all of these different things will impact the nervous system in a negative way and create that stress response. And stress suppresses ovulation and therefore lowers progesterone. And that's going to affect our sleep if we're not making progesterone. So one of the biggest ways to encourage ovulation and therefore progesterone is managing stress, supporting the nervous system, of course. You know, it's not just about supporting progesterone. This is about supporting cortisol balance, because cortisol is important. It plays a huge role in the body clock. We need it to be high in the morning for that cortisol awakening response, and we need it to taper off for the rest of the day and get low at night. In place of it, we make melatonin. But of course, cortisol is also the stress hormone. So if we're constantly spiking, or, you know, in that fight flight response a lot of the time, then we're dysregulating cortisol. And because cortisol has this big role in our circadian rhythm, that's going to put the circadian rhythm out as well. So there's so many reasons why we want to be supporting stress and nervous system. So incorporating just some calming rituals that we can do, like I mentioned, sort of in the evening, like yoga nidra, the lying down body scan meditation, or any other guided meditation before bed, any sort of gentle stretching, gentle yoga, yin practices, restorative yoga, EFT tapping, emotional freedom technique. Tapping has also been shown to be so calming and anti-anxiety. That's just a tapping routine that you can learn. It's available on YouTube. You'll find an EFT practitioner on YouTube. If you tap in EFT tapping routine or sequence, you'll find a practitioner on there who will just explain how to do it in a short video. just learn it off by heart, and then you can just do it yourself in the evening for a few minutes. Very simple to do. I say this thinking, yep, very simple to do. I should be doing this. I kind of lose sight of these tools every so often, just like everybody else. So it's a nice reminder for myself. And things that can support vagal tone that we talked about earlier, and the more vagal tone we have, the more stress resilient we're going to feel, the calmer we're going to feel, the better sleep we're likely to have. So things like deep, slow breathing. So the 4-6 breathing ratio is something I talk about a lot. Breathing in to a count of 4, breathing out to a longer count of 6. And that slower, longer out breath has been shown to increase vagal tone, calm the brain, calm the nervous system. Humming. So the sort of om chant that you would do in yoga, that's a form of humming. And just humming to yourself. Again, reminder to myself, when I'm cooking, when I'm cleaning, when I'm washing up, just hum. It's been shown to be very parasympathetic activating. So that's basically activating the parasympathetic nervous system, the rest and digest state, and improving vagal tone. Singing works on the same principle. So love a sing in the shower, just do it. Cold water splashing your face even. You know, it doesn't have to be this big dip. You don't have to go into the big cold dip if you're not one of those, that sort of person that wants to do that. But even just splashing water, cold, ice cold water onto your face in the morning can be really helpful for the cortisol awakening response and for vagal tone support as well. So some people will just have a bowl of ice water in the fridge, and they just keep it in the fridge all the time with some cling film over it. And in the morning, they'll just put, like, dunk their face in it or splash their face with it. So that could be something to try. Alcohol, being aware that alcohol and caffeine can often worsen hormonal sleep issues, or just sleep issues generally. Alcohol consumption in the evening during the night messes with blood sugar control as we're asleep, and can lead to blood sugar dips that wake us up. So any alcohol consumption will impact blood sugar regulation, because it just will. But let's say we're having a few glasses of wine in the evening. Some women, even just one glass of wine, they notice this. They can have this blood sugar dip in the middle of the night that wakes them up. Or if they say they haven't woken up, they'll just have a much less restorative sleep. So harder to get into a deep sleep state when the liver is busy clearing out alcohol, is very hard to get into the deep restorative sleep states. Caffeine spikes cortisol. So if we drink it too late in the day, it can interfere with melatonin production at night, and of course, sleep quality. The one last thing to say, which isn't the first sort of go-to when I'm working one-to-one with a client on sleep issues, but it is something that we might investigate if all of the above, everything I just spoke about, doesn't help or just only helps to a certain point. Some potential underlying issues can be, after you've addressed the basics, you're still waking up frequently. It can be gut-driven inflammation. So things like unknown chronic parasites, parasitic infections, yeast overgrowth, so candida, mold infections. If you're living in mold, that can be an issue. If you've got mold, but you were living in mold and it's colonized in the body, maybe you're not in the mold anymore or you've got rid of it. But if it's been colonized in the body, and you don't sort of realize it's there, that can be an inflammatory process going on all the time that can be waking us up in the night. Just other sort of chronic infections in the body that we're just, unaware of. They can keep the body in what we'd say a threat state and be activating cortisol at night when at a time we want it to be low. So those are things that I would investigate. Or if a client, from looking at their intake form, I can see that they're a likely candidate for potentially having parasites or yeast overgrowth, then we might look into that from the off. But otherwise, it would be something I would look into later if the basics just haven't helped. Really the last thing to say is sleep challenges in perimenopause, they're not all in your head. You're not going mad, and it's also not just something you should live with. Oh, I'm just in perimenopause, because a lot of things do nowadays get chalked up to perimenopause. We make jokes out of it. Oh, I'm not sleeping, it's perimenopause, or bloody perimenopause, or, I'm not remembering things anymore. And we can't just chalk it up to perimenopause and leave it there. There are things that we can do your lifestyle, nutrition, certain supportive supplements if they apply to you, that can support all of these things, despite the fact that this is going on, despite the fact that progesterone is declining, estrogen is erratic, and it will eventually decline, and we will eventually stop making these hormones. Despite all of that, there's so much we can do to support it, which by now I'm sure you know and understand that, otherwise you wouldn't be listening to my podcast. And if this is the first episode you're listening to, I hope that this is, you know, helped you see, at just using sleep as an example, that there is so much we can do. We can't just chalk everything up to perimenopause and okay, well, I'll just replace my hormones. Whilst that can be very helpful, we have to do the lifestyle stuff. We have to do the nutrition stuff as well, if we want things to be optimal and we want to feel great and, you know, live our lives and not be disrupted by all of this. So your sleep challenges, that they're a reflection of your shifting hormones and how they interact with your brain, your nervous system, and your circadian rhythm. And we can support that. The more we understand these patterns, the more we can start to do, because the more we understand what to do, and we can really just, you know, restore deeper sleep and start to have no troubles falling asleep, no trouble staying asleep. I have to say, I don't have trouble falling asleep. I rarely wake. If I do wake up in the night, it's a genuine need to go to the toilet for a wee, because I've had too much herbal tea in the evening, which I still slap my wrist for, but I can't help it, because I just really enjoy my herbal tea. But the nights that I don't do that, I don't need to wake up to go to the toilet. So for me, I sort of know that that's what it is. Different times of my cycle, when I'm due on my period a few days before, I'll have some wake ups. That's all, you know, that's just normal. It doesn't have to, you know, it shouldn't always be like that, but I know what that is. And again, I go straight back to sleep. I don't have any issues falling back to sleep. I'm still not suffering with, you know, waking up at 4 a.m. and can't fall back to sleep. I'd say that's probably happened to me maybe once, maybe twice, you know, since I've turned 40, and I'm nearly 46. So just to show you that it does not have to be like this. You don't have to struggle with your sleep. There are reasons. Yes, there's hormonal reasons, but there are very, very likely lifestyle, nutrition reasons why it's more of an impact for you. Because yes, the hormonal shifts are going to create sleep issues, but if we do the right things with our habits, we can counteract it. And I know that because I'm doing that. My clients are doing that now. And they're also sleeping better now. They're like, tick, that is something I can cross off the list. And that has such a huge impact to everything else. We know that, you know, one night of poor sleep, whatever age you are, whatever gender you are, ruins your day in different ways, right? You can't lift as heavy if you're going to the gym. You can't run as fast if you're running. You know, you don't perform as well, and we don't feel as well. So, and our appetite goes off. So this is a really, really big thing to cross off the list, if we can. So I hope this has been helpful. If you would like some one-to-one support from me, check the show notes for how to contact me to set that up. Drop me an email, francesca@francescaliparotti.com, DM me on Instagram, whatever's easiest for you. And of course, if you want to join the Midlife Thrive membership, which is now ready to go. This is a very affordable cancel anytime membership where you get access to modules, educational modules on absolutely everything I talk about on the podcast and a whole lot more. Sleep being one of the, has its own module. Come in, get access to that for as long as you stay in the membership, which could be a year, could be 2 years, could be 6 months, whatever you choose. It's cancel anytime. And we have a monthly group coaching call that you can jump on every month, ask your personal questions. And there's also an online community that's, you know, you have access to every single day. So do jump in on that as well if you think that that's a good fit for you. The details of that are also in the show notes. And I'll see you in the next episode. Bye bye.
If you found this episode helpful, then please share it with anyone else who you think could benefit. And consider leaving a rating and a review, as this will help the podcast to reach and help more people. And if you need more guidance on your own health journey, you can grab my free guide, 6 Steps to Mastering Your Hormones in Your 40s, over at francescaliparotti.com, where you can sign up for your free copy. Or you'll also find the link in the show notes.